Almost 50 years ago today, the world was introduced to the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour, the album, and the television special that did not get an overwhelming praise from critics at the time. But as our friend Colin Fleming tells us in a wonderful new piece in Salon, maybe it's time to revisit Magical Mystery Tour. It's a lot better than you might have been told. Colin, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, how's it going?
It's great, thank you. I hope you had a wonderful Christmas, and maybe you have rewatched Magical Mystery Tour, as everybody should. And as you wrote, the Salon piece was great, by the way. And this was really the Beatles' first venture on their own after an up-and-down 1967, including the loss of their manager.
Complete failure. Their first failure. But, as you know, failure can be good for you. Builds character. So Brian Epstein dies in late August of that year, and the Beatles, Paul McCartney especially, decide to be all gung-ho and carry on intrepidly with a cinematic project. But sort of like a truncated cinematic project. Not A Hard Day's Night, not a feature-length film, not a Help, but something for this day, Boxing Day, which means, well, nothing really to us here in America, right? Maybe you gave the staff at Manor Kimball some presents today, but for most of us, it doesn't mean a lot. But in England, you kind of sit around, you hang out with your presents, you give presents to, like, the mailman, your house staff, and you just, well, kind of veg out, really, I think, is what the term would be. So you would have your chocolates, your sweets, put on the Beatles, Magical Mystery Tour, there they are, and it's like a 50-something minute film. And it didn't just tank. It went to the bottom of the ocean and through the ocean floor, basically.
Now, was part of it, Colin, the timing, that it was up against some pretty standard holiday fare, and this certainly was anything but standard?
No, it could have been up against the worst ever episode of ALF, and it would have, I think, met with the reaction that it did. Now, it is nowhere near as bad as critics have sort of branded it. I think with the expectations that people had, don't forget, just a few short months before, in June, Sgt. Pepper comes out. Earlier in the year, the double A-side single, Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields Forever. The Magical Mystery Tour EP is pretty good in and of itself. Their second best EP after the Long Tall Sally one. So you have these expectations on a very sort of circumscribed timeline with the Beatles. They only existed as a commercial band for 7 years. So it's almost like dog years. Going from June to day after Christmas for the Beatles is like, well, it's like 5-6 years, really, for another band. I mean, now it's like 20 years. But you would have thought, okay, they've really been away for a while. They've gotten it together. How is this going to go over? Should be brilliant. And it's kind of like a student art film, and it doesn't cohere in many ways. But you could say the same thing about some films from the French New Wave. If you've sat through a lot of Godard films, you've had a similar experience to what you might get with parts of Magical Mystery Tour.
And McCartney was the driving force behind this, and he had been immersed in several different film schools and theories and approaches to things. But it's interesting, too, as you point out, that while it was very much a McCartney project, he put John Lennon front and center.
That's a strange kind of thing. You're right. Lennon was a very lazy individual. He slept incredibly late. The only time he wasn't lazy, and this seems like a paradox, contradiction almost, was when he was writing. And then the Beatles were like the antithesis of lazy, really, when they sat down to work. Like, we have to go. You know how when you do things in life and you reach that point where you can't put off the deadline anymore, it's like, okay, it's go time. They were very good at that, and they would work at a much faster rate than others, Lennon included. But McCartney was the one who had been living in London, who sort of spearheaded within himself this evolution quest, really, to learn more, to binge watch film, to read everything, to get immersed in avant-garde classical music. And he says, okay, fellas, let's do this. And Lennon, he narrates, well, until they just decide they're not going to have a narrator anymore. He narrates the beginning of it before it kind of falls apart. And he has this wonderfully sing-song voice that works well for it. Like, if you've heard him read excerpts from either of his books, or, you know, the way Dylan Thomas would read A Child's Christmas in Wales, it has that cadence to it, that natural kind of storyteller's cadence, and then they sort of improvise a film around that, parts of which work better than other parts.
You wrote, Colin, that the film is in many ways the beginning of the end of the Beatles. What do you mean by that?
I think that McCartney's drive to carry on all the time. You know how when you see Tom Brady come off the field and he yells, "Let's go!" You know, if the Patriots weren't winning with the consistency that they do, that his teammates would be like, "Oh, this guy, here we go again." Always, right? It just, it would be annoying. A lot of mirth can kind of go a long way, and I think that's what was happening with the Beatles. Now, if McCartney had just sat back, a lot of things don't happen. I mean, I think this film was one of the reasons why in 1968 they're going so gangbusters and writing songs to sort of recover, to prove that we can do this. And that ends up becoming the White Album. And McCartney, too, I feel like he took that directive up himself with the Hey Jude single. But I think they began to resent McCartney. Like, Yoko Ono always gets the blame. Things have a shelf life, though. And I think when you lose a key member, that's what Brian Epstein was, in a sense, and someone else becomes the driver, the other people who have sort of been besotted with success can get irked at that person.
You also point out that the videos, the music videos, essentially, that were in this for I Am the Walrus and others were really the template for what future generations of artists would use.
That's the big-time cutting-edge stuff in the film. I mean, a lot of it's them just rolling around the English countryside in the van, getting out and kind of like hopping around and filming it and being all 1960s arty. It's amazing the contrast with something like the film numbers for I Am the Walrus. They put so much care into the editing of those sequences where you're seeing these cuts, and within the space of a cut, entire costumes change, or maybe just like somebody's headdress changes. So there's actually continuity. They're paying attention to this. It's storyboarded out, in a sense, as a music video. I read a piece recently saying that I Am the Walrus was the Beatles' most meaningless song. And I have a hard time coming anywhere close to accepting that, because I think it's one of the more meaningful. It's about the locus of identity and trying to ascertain what our identity is, which is not the easiest game that we can play with ourselves, really, to kind of ferret out that truth. So I think the music video really kind of underscores that visually, and just the way that's like super effective. You watch and it's like, wow, that is just, that's the big boy part of this film. And all of the musical numbers work really well like that. And also they do this interesting thing where they reference A Hard Day's Night a number of times. They use some of the same music. Lennon's whole, remember the bathtub routine in A Hard Day's Night?
Right.
Doing Rule Britannia, Britannia Rules the Sea. There's that in the film. It's reprised. So it's just very interesting that they're playing off their own cinematic history somewhat.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. And while we're exploring the Beatles, too, you're working on a brand new book called Same Band You've Never Known, An Alternative Musical History of the Beatles. And part of that is to talk about their live recordings that for some reason get short shrift from those early days at the Star Club in Hamburg.
Right. That's the first chapter of the book, actually, because I think the better an artist is, the less their identity is about kind of the things that we all choose to focus on. Like, for instance, if you wanted to extend it to sports and you wanted to try to convince someone of how great Wayne Gretzky was, yes, you can point to 8-point games he had, right? Or a 5-goal game to get to 50 goals in 39 games. But it's the games in between where every single game he's a goal and 2 assists. Every single game, because when you're that good, it's like you have a quantity of a liquid, and that liquid is of quality that never changes, and you just pour it into different sized buckets. And for the Beatles, one of those first compelling buckets to me were the Hamburg Star Club recordings, which have this very dubious legality right from the drop, because a guy in another band thinking, oh, it's Beatles, they're not so bad. This could work out for them. This is the end of 1962, so they've recorded, released Love Me Do, that reaches number 17 in the charts in October. This is their last Hamburg stint, and they don't want to be there because things are happening back home. There's nothing more to prove or achieve in Hamburg, but contractually they have to go back. So this guy in another band says, oh, yeah, can I record you? And Lennon says, well, sure, but you have to buy the beer for tonight. So it's like scribbled out on the cocktail napkin. They put the microphone, just cheap tape recorder, like whatever you had in like 1981. This is worlds worse than that. And you can hear how so much of their sound, it's fascinating because of the placement of the recorder, is built up from Lennon's rhythm guitar. Because no one thinks of him as a guitarist, right? Think of like George Harrison and McCartney Stornley playing the solos on Taxman. But so much of the rhythm, even like Starr's drum parts, are kind of cued from Lennon's rhythm guitar. And it's their only Hamburg sojourn with Ringo Starr as a full-time member of the band.
This is the anniversary of the day in 1963 when I Want to Hold Your Hand and I Saw Her Standing There were released in the United States. And around this same time, December of 63, they did what you say was one of their best gigs ever, a homecoming performance in Liverpool.
Yes, so we're going, that would be December 7th, 63. So the Hamburg run is December 18th through the 31st. So again, we have that whole sort of weird Doctor Who-y notion of time, right, where it's really compacted. And they are doing the show in Liverpool, and they're referencing the Cavern Club, which they've just stopped playing, basically. And they're kind of just having chit-chat from the stage with their fans. And it's bittersweet because these fans, I mean, no one knew what they were going to become globally. That's still a few months away. But it's very much a farewell. And also, Hamburg is this farewell. And they are, for a group who didn't want to go to Hamburg, they are having, clearly, a blast. I mean, we have to consider it. The Beatles, they never intended, well, eventually they did, but not at this point, to be these sonic mages, these wizards who would use the studio as an instrument. That would have been almost seen as fey for them. That would have been beneath them, something like arty and classical music-y. Not what they wanted to be. They wanted to be able to cover any song by other people. They didn't even care about writing their own songs and blow anyone else off the stage who might follow them. So at Hamburg, we have an embryonic version of I Saw Her Standing There. But by the time we get to Liverpool the next year, it's just like, oh my goodness, you wrote all these songs? These are nuts. Who does this? They went from this bar band to this bar band with incredible writing chops. Boom. 11 months. Here you go.
And was it, I'm trying to recall my Beatles history here, wasn't it at those Star Club shows that they first became acquainted with both Klaus Voormann, who had a huge impact on them, and Astrid Kircher?
Yes. And that's where the whole Stuart Sutcliffe thing goes down. So again, with their whole timeline, earlier in 62, when they're going to Hamburg, before really everything is happening with Parlophone Records and George Martin, they're learning of Stuart Sutcliffe's death. So they're sacking Pete Best in that summer. They're adding Ringo. Now, this is a little misleading, the whole how did Ringo fit in so quickly thing. I am someone who thinks that the only rock drummer better than Ringo Starr is Keith Moon. And Keith Moon could not have existed in any other band, because he wouldn't have been able to play that way, than The Who. So in terms of serving a song compositionally and thinking creatively, Ringo was just, he was the virtuoso in the band. I know no one ever thinks that, and it goes to McCartney, and he's the James Jamerson of bass players for like English rock bands. But Ringo Starr completely overhauled aspects of their sound. But he had sat in with them many times before because they were always eyeing him. So when they just, it was like that flashpoint where everything, it's not a pun, but comes together and they're joking from the stage. They're making, well, some of it you can't say on radio like this, but it's very much in the spirit of who they were. More so, I would say, than with the Beatles, A Hard Day's Night, Beatles for Sale. You see an element of it with the BBC sessions, where they're doing the same kind of thing. They're joking around, but you have the sense that they're in suits. They're not in leather. They're still in leather in Hamburg, and they retain that spirit in their live performances, basically up until like the middle of their 1964 world tour.
make sure you go to Salon.com and check out Colin's piece, A New Way of Looking at the Beatles' Biggest Disaster, Magical Mystery Tour. Time for a reevaluation of that. Always great talking with you, Colin. Thank you so much. A happy new year to you, and we look forward to visiting again next week.
Okay, sounds great.